I'm Terry Cooper. I'm the brand new program committee chairman. And as Rich indicated, we're trying to put together a gangbusters list of programs for you for this year. When you get a notice of an upcoming meeting, what I'd like each of you to do is read it and ask yourself, who do I know that maybe is not a regular attendee, but would be interested in this program, and forward a copy to them, because we want to expand our attendance and expand our membership list. Now, to go ahead with today's program, we're introducing our new local Commonwealth attorneys, Joe Platania from the city and Robert Tracy from the county. Joe was elected Commonwealth's attorney this past November and took office just 9 days ago. He has been with the Commonwealth's attorney's office in Charlottesville since 2003. And for much of that time, he also served as a special assistant United States attorney helping prosecute federal criminal cases. Joe is a graduate of Providence College and the Washington and Lee University School of Law. Before joining the City Commonwealth's Attorney's Office, he was an assistant public defender here in Charlottesville, and before that, an appellate attorney for the Virginia Capital Representation Resource Center in Richmond. He is the current president of the Charlottesville Albemarle Bar Association. Robert Tracy was elected Commonwealth's attorney for the county in November of 2015. Before that, he had been a special assistant U.S. attorney and a deputy assistant attorney general, dealing with violations of federal criminal law. Before that, he had been a senior staff member of the United States House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary. That is the committee that deals with criminal law and criminal procedure, voting rights, intellectual property, antitrust, and a whole variety of other legal matters. Robert's a Phi Beta Kappa alumnus of Ohio Wesleyan University and a graduate of the University of Illinois College of Law. Joe is going to start with a few remarks, followed by Robert, and when they are through, as Rich indicated, we will be passing mics for questions. Joe?
Good afternoon. Robert and I would like to thank the senior statesmen of Virginia for having us. Thank Terry Cooper and the board. We're pleased to be here. So I ran for office for the first time ever and ran in a Democratic primary this June and talked to a lot of different people to get some advice about how one runs for office. And one of the best pieces of advice I received was, well, when you're talking to people and asking for their vote, you better be able to tell them why you want the job. And that might sound obvious, but I hadn't really thought of it that way. So before I endeavored on the campaign, I put some time into thinking about why I wanted to be the Commonwealth's attorney in the city of Charlottesville. And I'd worked there for about 15 years. My boss, Dave Chapman, who had served for 24 years, was retiring, but I couldn't really just say, well, there's a vacancy. I didn't think that would go over too well. So the phrase I came up with that sort of spoke to why I wanted to do this was, I wanted to keep the community safe, but I also wanted to treat people charged with crime fairly, and I wanted to try and do both at the same time, and sort of hold both of those goals in my hands when I went about and did my job. And that led to sort of more in-depth discussions about community safety and fair treatment of offenders. But I'd like to tell two quick stories that I think illustrate the point. Several years ago, I was prosecuting mainly violent crime in the city of Charlottesville. That's what I sort of specialized in. And there were a series of shootings. And when our detectives would respond to the scene of the shooting, there would be someone that had been shot, and the detectives would say, hey, you know, who did this? What's going on? Let's file a report. Let's try and locate the person that did this and charge them and have them prosecuted. And the the folks that were the victims of these shootings were completely uncooperative with the police and said, I didn't see anything. I don't know nothing about nothing. I don't want to file a report. I just want to get to the hospital. And what we pretty quickly realized is that there were two groups of folks in the city that were sort of going back and forth shooting at each other over probably something really important, like, you know, a girl or, you know, what, an argument about something. But, you know, it was escalating. And there were a series of about 4 to 5 of these shootings. And in meeting with detectives, we became concerned that someone that was an innocent bystander was going to be struck and killed, or a bullet would go through a wall and strike a sleeping child. And we were gravely concerned about what to do about this issue. And we had a lot of information about who these folks were and what they were doing, but none of it we could, you know, bring to court and have as admissible evidence. So we sat down with some of the narcotics detectives, and we sat down with an FBI agent and an agent from DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, and we put a plan together since we had identified some of these folks that were doing these shootings. We put a plan together and we put an organizational chart together, and they enlisted informants and put cameras on them, and they started buying heroin and crack from some of these people because they were also selling drugs to sort of support their violent activity. Not only were they buying drugs from these individuals, but they started buying firearms from these individuals. They also would have the camera on as they were talking to these folks, and they were driving around in cars selling cocaine and heroin with an assault rifle on their laps, and they captured that. And what they did over time is they built a case against 9 different individuals, and they ended up coming to me, and we sat down and organized the evidence we had against these 9 folks that were involved in this violence and shooting and guns and drugs, and we indicted and arrested all 9 of them. And guess what happened when those 9 people were arrested and locked up? The shooting stopped because we had identified those folks, and they were all prosecuted, and some pled guilty, and some went to trial. But we were successful in building a case, and it's one of the things I love most about my job is building a case with detectives and really feeling like we made the community a safer place by taking some of these folks off the street for a couple years that were doing this sort of stuff. So that's the community safety story. And there's many examples of cases I've done and many others in the office, and same with Robert and his assistants have done about community safety. But the other thing that's very important to me and is important to the citizens of Charlottesville is the fair treatment of folks charged with the crime. Because a lot of the people that we prosecute aren't like these guys running around shooting people and selling crack and heroin. It's really not the majority of who we deal with as prosecutors. It's mainly people that have made poor decisions and mistakes. And they're not really bad people for the most part. And they're not evil people for the most part. They've made bad decisions. And so how do you, as a prosecutor, in the exercise of your discretion, treat someone fairly that's made a mistake? And there's a tremendous amount of power that goes with that. And I am humbled by it every day. I teach a class at the law school, and I tell third-year law students, if you want to prosecute and you become a prosecutor, you should wake up every day terrified at the power you have to affect somebody's life. You really should every single day wake up and say, I can do a tremendous amount of good, or I can do a tremendous amount of harm. So the story related to fair treatment of offenders actually is a story from a colleague of mine. He was in court, and he was prosecuting someone for a drug offense, and the detective had written a search warrant for this gentleman's house, and they executed the search warrant and found a large amount of drugs inside of the house. And the search warrant was based on a confidential informant saying, I had seen certain things. And there's a standard that says if you use an informant for a search warrant, they've got to be reliable. So the defense attorney said, I'm going to attack this informant as not being reliable. So he asked the detective on the stand, how do you know the person giving you information was reliable? And the detective said, well, I've worked with him about 6 times, and he'd made other cases, and they had the information had all checked out, and he sort of went through and said he was reliable every time I dealt with him and was truthful. And the defense attorney said, okay, that sounds pretty good. I don't think I have an argument here. Judge, we're going to change our plea to guilty based on the fact that my challenge to the reliability of the informant is not going anywhere. And the defendant pled guilty, and the defendant was guilty. The defendant had the drugs in the house, and the defendant was guilty. And the judge sentenced this person to about 8 years in prison. And everyone went home, and that was the end of the case. Well, the detective started thinking about this informant and his testimony, and he said, you know, I'm pretty sure that this person's reliable, but I want to go back and check some notes because there's just something that's nagging at me. And he went back and checked his notes, and he said, oh my goodness, all the reliability events I testified to happened after this search warrant. He didn't lie under oath. He didn't misrepresent anything to the court. He just got it wrong. He immediately called the prosecutor and said, my testimony was not accurate. That was not a reliable informant. That happened after the search warrant. Now, the prosecutor could have been like, the guy's guilty. He's been sentenced. The case is over. No one will ever know about this. Don't worry about it. That's wrong for many reasons. And what the prosecutor did was said, thank you. You did exactly what you're supposed to do. Called the defense attorney the next day, said, we got to get this back in front of the judge. Called the judge, said, let's get this back on the docket. The prosecutor reopened the case, put the detective back on, corrected the misinformation, said, judge, this actually should be suppressed. This was not the way, the rules were not followed here. No one was being dishonest or malicious, but we're moving to reopen the case, ask you to grant the suppression motion and exclude the evidence and dismiss the charge against this guy. And that's exactly what happened. And I love that story because what it exhibits is our job, and I say this sometimes when I try cases in front of juries, and the jurors all look at me like I've got two heads. Robert's job and my job is not to convict people. It's not. Our job is not to convict people and put them in prison. Our job, and Robert's going to talk about this a little bit, I think, our job is to treat people fairly and to seek justice. That's what we're supposed to do in each and every case, whether it's popular or unpopular or a guilty person that, you know, has an 8-year sentence goes free. Our job is to each and every case seek justice. And so those are sort of two anecdotes I wanted to share with you. Looking forward to answering your questions. But community safety along with fair treatment of offenders is why I ran for office. And it's going well for the first 9 days.
Thank you all for being here, and thank the senior statesman and the senior center for all the important work you do here as well. I want to first thank all of you again, but also congratulate Joe Platania for running a quality race and winning against an opponent who I have respect for as well. I think he did a good job articulating and framing issues in a principled way. Everything that Joe said is absolutely correct. And to distill what he said into two words when I was running for this position was tough and fair. You can be very proactive in trying to hold people accountable while maintaining the safeguards and civil liberties and the traditions that set our system of justice above all others. And that's a very important distinction to make. It's true that the role of a prosecutor is to seek justice, not merely to convict. And that's not us. That's in the rules of professional responsibility and the special obligations of prosecutors. To that point, in the federal system where I had previous experience, an assistant United States attorney will report to the managing assistant United States attorney, and then to the criminal chief back in Roanoke, and then to the first assistant U.S. attorney, then to the U.S. attorney, then to the deputy attorney general, then the EOUSA, the Executive Office of U.S. Attorney, then up the chain to ultimately the Attorney General and the President. In our constitutional system in Virginia, it's much different. We are elected constitutional officers accountable to you all. And that's a mandate and a charge that I take very seriously, and I know Joe does as well, but a very humbling responsibility as well to make sure we're getting it right. In ensuring that we're being proactive, holding people accountable while being fair. In terms of other obligations, and we're not at liberty to speak specifically about pending cases, mostly because when we do, we might interfere with the ability of someone to obtain a fair and neutral jury of his peers should those cases proceed. But in terms of some of the issues that I've been working on, consistent with our ethical obligations as attorneys, as prosecutors, to seek improvements to the criminal justice system, are issues that some of you in the Senior Center are aware of because I've been here with some of our partners in a elder abuse task force that I created, or we created, and Joe was a partner with that task force, called the Jefferson Area Coalition to End Elder Abuse and Exploitation. I know it's a mouthful, but I was just tired of task force this and task force that. Doris Geldman's a part of it. You might know her. She's an incredible advocate for people in the community. Job is a member of it. Joe's office is a member of it. The U.S. Attorney's Office, VSP, Virginia State Police, FBI is a part of it. And this is a multi-jurisdictional group that meets regularly to investigate and to examine reports of elder abuse and exploitation in our community. This is an issue that I take very seriously, because I think ultimately we're going to be at least partially assessed on how we treat vulnerable people. And this is a very important issue to me personally, and I want to just emphasize the commitment of my office and our office to this issue. Since we created this task force, we've had more referrals, more prosecutions, and more sentences that reflect the severity of the underlying offense. Another thing I mentioned when I was running that I'd work on was a DNA enhancement. And I worked with Sheriff Harding to expand the list of misdemeanors for which DNA samples are collected post-conviction. And to me, it's a very important issue for a number of reasons, dramatized in a way that was impossible to ignore as a result of the Hannah Graham case, where Jesse Matthew was convicted of criminal trespass in Charlottesville in 2009, I believe. And if his DNA had been recovered after that event, it would have gone to the data bank and matched the DNA underneath the fingernails of the victim from Fairfax. He would have been immediately arrested within hours, probably. And none of the subsequent tragedy would have occurred in our community. So I was happy to try to do what I could to emphasize the importance and the urgency of passing legislation to expand that DNA data bank. Went up to the General Assembly, to the Virginia Crime Commission, with Sheriff Harding and Susan Graham, mother of Hannah. Very private person, but felt obligated to act. And it was a unanimous bipartisan vote to expand the list of offenses. And I proceeded from the assumption that it was completely nonpartisan. David Toscano was very helpful. Senator Obenchain was very helpful. Rob Bell was helpful. There had been some reluctance, but everyone recognized the importance of limited expansion, preserving civil liberties in a way that not only identifies the guilty, but exonerates the innocent. Because we've had people on death row who have been exonerated as a result of DNA evidence. When we recover more samples for Class 1 misdemeanors, we have more dots to connect and more opportunities to not only identify the guilty, but to exonerate the innocent, which is an important obligation we all have as prosecutors. Another thing that I'm proud of is establishing for the first time in Central Virginia a multi-jurisdictional grand jury that permits witnesses to come before the grand jury and testify under oath about criminal activity in our community. It's the first time we've had one in Central Virginia's history. And some of the cases that we're bringing recently are a result of that mechanism that exists for the first time. And so I'm proud of that as well. So I have one question about administrative costs. I think someone asked me about that. Our office is about $1.2 million budget. Most of that comes from the State Compensation Board in Richmond, but the County of Albemarle does supplement our budget, for which we are all very grateful. It's an expensive place to live, as we all know. But we also recognize that it's a burden on taxpayers to expect them to continue to fund new positions. So I recently got a new position appointed and confirmed from Richmond, so the Albemarle taxpayers aren't footing the entire bill. And the number of attorneys in the office is 7, with an additional on the way. So with that, I will be happy to yield to any questions you have, and want to thank you again for the invitation to be here.
Hi, Joe. We will be taking questions now. While we get the microphones out, if you have a question, raise your hand, signal to the person with the microphone. then I will recognize you, and you can ask your questions. Let me ask one to begin with. It's a two-part question, Robin, Joe. Part one, to what extent is the opioid addiction problem in this area? And second part of it is, what advice would you give us as individuals if one of our children or grandchildren appears to be caught up in that?
It's a significant issue. Fortunately, this community is not as vulnerable and susceptible to the overprescription that we see in some more rural communities in Southern Virginia, in particular. But it's something that I care deeply about, and met with the president of Sentara, Martha Jefferson, and Pam Sutton Wallace at UVA early on to ask them how they can help limit the overprescription of some of these opioids. And UVA in particular has a very impressive model that we spoke about, and I've communicated with other Commonwealth attorneys, where they have shown that you can reduce the level of opioids prescribed for post-surgical pain without increasing the pain scores that are a part of the Medicare and Medicaid evaluation post-surgery. It's a massive problem, and it's really, we almost lose sight of the scope of the problem by just repeating the staggering figures involved. It's 500,000, half a million drug overdoses in the United States since 2000. Median life expectancy is declining for the first time in American history as a result of this epidemic. It's 5 or 6 747s a week are crashing. And I think the administration, starting, you know, with the White House and President Trump, have not done enough. This is an area that is uniquely situated and uniquely requires federal intervention. And just speak briefly about legislation I personally worked on when I was on Capitol Hill, was a Combat Methamphetamine Act, where we had a similar problem sweeping the country. And what we did is we eliminated all of those pseudoephedrine precursors that were over the counter, limited the availability of those drugs, and attached pretty significant penalties, not only to low-level dealers, but people who are putting this junk into our community, and create enterprise liability for some of these larger traffickers, but also synchronize the authority of the ability of federal agents and synchronize federal enforcement, DEA, ATF, FBI, HHS, U.S. Attorney's Office, in coordination with state and local people, to really address this problem aggressively. We've been as proactive as we can. We utilize the drug court in Albemarle County. A lot of people thought I would, you know, stop sending people to drug court. I think it's a very important tool we have in the community to get people the help that they deserve. But we need to be doing more, and certainly it's a consideration that we all are trying to move forward with.
And the other part of the question, Robert, about what would you advise us?
I just talked for 5 minutes.
Okay. Oh.
Unless I'd be happy to, but I don't want to. Go ahead.
Well, I'll say this. Tim Hafey, who was the United States Attorney for the Western District of Virginia under President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder, I always have to cite Tim, but he described a safe and stable community as a stool with three legs. And the three legs of the stool were enforcement, prevention and education, and reentry. And so the enforcement piece is what Robert and I do. We prosecute people and enforce the laws. The prevention and education angle is where you try and sort of get to people before they hit the criminal justice system. And then reentry is where you're dealing with individuals that are being released from jails and prisons, and you've got to provide them with resources and options to reintegrate back into the community. We cannot prosecute our way out of this or any other drug crisis. We just can't do it. There needs to be an enforcement leg of that stool, because you need to disincentivize folks that are trafficking in these substances. And so you do want to prosecute the dealers. But if you've got addicts that are selling to support a habit, which is commonplace, they can be charged with distribution of heroin and distribution of drugs. Those are not the type of people that we want to be incarcerating. Those are addicts selling to support a habit. And while neither of us condone it, you need to get them into treatment. And so, as Robert mentioned, we have a very robust drug court program between the city and the county. It's the second oldest in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It just celebrated its 20-year anniversary. We need to divert people into treatment that are struggling with addiction issues. We need to get into the schools. We need to get into anywhere we can to do prevention and education. But Robert and I, we're not the prevention leg of that stool. We're not the education leg of that stool. We can assist with reentry services and support stuff like that, but we're the enforcement leg of the stool. So it's going to take a lot of different people partnering up to address this issue. And again, I think it's... I'm a little hesitant to sort of talk about the opioid crisis because that's sort of the new thing. And there are other drugs that are decimating communities beyond opioids. There's methamphetamine, there's crack cocaine in certain neighborhoods. So that's what's in the news lately. But make no mistake about it, these drugs that are being used and people are becoming addicted to, they are destroying communities. We've had, I know at least one city resident that was in drug treatment court die from an overdose. We have lost people in the city of Charlottesville, some of whom were in treatment. The other piece of it that's interesting is, I'm sure Robert gets this, but we get calls from family members that say, you need to arrest my spouse. You need to arrest my child. They need to be in jail right now because they are not stopping the use, and they're going to die, and they're going to overdose. And in the heroin use now, they're using fentanyl along with the heroin. And law enforcement agents are being trained. They could die from an overdose by touching the fentanyl. So it's such, you know, I'm sure there's some medical professionals out there, but it is such potent stuff right now. But, you know, there is a role that the criminal justice system can play, and it's called coerced treatment. You know, it's sort of like we're going to either put you in jail or prison, or you're going to get yourself help. And there is some literature that coerced treatment works. But it's also tough because you can't make someone want to be sober. You just can't. And so they have to want to get there themselves. It's a very complicated problem. But again, I think it's evident, but there's a pretty close partnership between the city and county law enforcement, prosecutors' offices. It's really sort of one criminal justice system where we try and tackle these problems together.
Let's say one word on that, and I'm not a medical professional by any stretch of the imagination, but I went over to UVA for grand surgery rounds probably 6 months ago. I was invited over, and the person giving the presentation said that if the FDA knew what they know now about OxyContin and these other opioid-based drugs, which are essentially molecular, from a molecular standpoint, heroin, there's no way they would have ever approved it. And that resonated with me as a non-medical person. And another thing that I learned was the United States has about 5% of the global population, but we consume about 85% of the opioids. And that's not because Americans are more vulnerable to pain than 95% of the global population. These communities are being bombarded with these drugs, particularly rural communities in West Virginia. The numbers are staggering, off the charts. So I'm not interested in having anyone suffer at all, but there are consequences that are difficult to ignore with respect to the overprescription of this class of drugs, in my view.
Next question.
Thank you very much for coming. Could you just take a second and outline for us the structure of the state system and the federal system and the judges and the prosecutors, how it all fits together, what are the areas that are your responsibilities, what's the responsibility of the federal prosecutors, what's the responsibility of the courts?
Okay, go ahead.
I'll start with the state system and then throw it over to Robert for the federal. I think we both worked in each. So the state system, as Robert said, each municipality in the Commonwealth of Virginia, each county or city, has its own Commonwealth Attorney's Office, an elected Commonwealth Attorney. So there's the Commonwealth's attorney and then the Commonwealth's attorney's assistants that are all appointed. And we prosecute all the criminal cases that occur in our locality, misdemeanors, traffic offenses, and felonies. And so there's really three state courts in Virginia. There's a general district court, which is a lower court, where you have misdemeanors and traffic offenses and felony probable cause hearings. That's the general district court. There's the juvenile and domestic relations general district court, and those are cases, criminal cases, that involve juveniles that are defendants, juveniles that are victims, or crimes where the defendant and the victim are family or household members, and then also those cases have some felonies that go up to the third court in Virginia, which is the circuit court. That's sort of the higher court. That's a court of record. It's more formal. There's a court reporter there. And what happens in circuit court are all the misdemeanor appeals, all the felony trials, felony probation violations. So there's three different courts in each municipality: general district court, juvenile and domestic relations general district court, and then the higher court, circuit court. And then if you have convictions, you can appeal them to two appellate courts in Virginia, the Court of Appeals and the Virginia Supreme Court. And then there's a recent case out of Albemarle County. If there's a constitutional issue, it could go up to the United States Supreme Court if they grant the petition. So that's kind of a – does that answer your question about the state system?
Right. And you have different prosecutors in the different positions as well. In other words, you handle certain cases –
Could you hold until you get
to Oh, I'm sorry. You said not to.
So you have, that's the state system, but there's also the federal system, right?
And Robert's going to talk about the federal system.
Right.
But
okay,
the state system is offenses that are violations of state law.
Right.
And
right.
So we have the state code 18.2 lists all the different state criminal offenses. And then there's also federal court.
Right, right. Okay, good. Thanks.
And I'll let you talk about the federal's criminal system.
And 18.2 is a Virginia statute for the felonies and the federal code. It's Title 18. So whenever you hear people talking about Title 18, that's the federal code pertaining to those felony offenses. There are 94 judicial districts, each of which has a United States attorney appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, or not. Without moving a whole lot of them right now. And there are, magistrate court judges that do some of the preliminary hearings and kind of certify cases, just like in the state system. And then the district court judges, like the one here in Charlottesville and in Lynchburg. And then there are circuit courts that you can appeal. The Fourth Circuit is our local circuit court. And then you appeal up to the Supreme Court by writ of certiorari. Very difficult to get to the Supreme Court, as everyone knows. Very few cases are actually heard. Most of those cases don't even get to the circuit court or the appellate court. And the one distinguishing characteristic, just emphasize again, is the number of intermediate stages in the federal system versus the constitutional fabric embedded in the Virginia Constitution with respect to the accountability of Commonwealth's attorneys, too. And it's not a position, and when I talk about the office, I don't like the possessive because it's really a constitutional position temporarily entrusted to whoever is there, but one that is directly accountable to the voters every 4 years. And the Board of Supervisors needs to know that. I'm just joking. Sometimes this has come up with respect to the issues of constitutional autonomy of the office, and they're insulated. The Commonwealth's attorneys are insulated from political pressure for precisely that reason. But we get along very well. Sorry.
I have two questions, basically about sentencing. I'd like to know what your view of mandatory sentencing is, and also if you could speak to the fact that we have no parole in Virginia, which we haven't, I think, since 1996 or thereabouts, and your view of that. Do you think we should have parole, and what do you think of mandatory sentencing?
Ms. Emery, are you going to identify yourself as a defense attorney? All right, well. I'll start with that one. So there's something in the state system called mandatory minimums. So if you possess a firearm after having been convicted of a violent felony, it is a mandatory 5-year prison sentence. A judge cannot do anything about it. The judge has to put you in prison for 5 years. If you are convicted of distribution of cocaine being a third offense, it is a mandatory minimum 10-year prison sentence. The judge cannot do anything other than put you in prison starting at 10 years. The good news is, as a prosecutor, you can say, well, I'm not going to charge you with being a felon in possession of a firearm after having been convicted of a violent felony. I'm going to leave out the violent part and just say you're a felon in possession of a gun. And all of a sudden, that 5-year mandatory minimum evaporates and it's not there. A judge can impose a 5-year prison sentence, but a judge does not have to. Same thing with that distribution of cocaine third offense charge. A prosecutor can say, I'm going to strike that third offense language from the indictment and just charge you with a regular first offense distribution. So that 10-year mandatory minimum disappears, and it's 5 to 40, and the judge can give you a completely suspended sentence. Personally, I have real problems with mandatory minimum sentences in the state system. I think it can lead to overcharging. I think it can lead to coerced guilty pleas. I think it can lead to situations where judges aren't able to exercise their discretion in ways that they ought. So I think that it should be something that if it's done by a prosecutor, it should be done with much thought and care, and you should have a reason that you're going to indict something with a mandatory minimum. And sometimes it is appropriate to do that. And again, I want to be very clear. I am speaking just for the City Commonwealth Attorney's Office. I would say that there may be widely divergent views on this from other prosecutors that think that they are useful and that judges' discretion should be limited in certain offenses. I've had detectives complain to me when I would not charge a mandatory minimum that I'm ignoring the will of the General Assembly. They said, well, if it's a distribution third offense and you have two priors that you can prove, the General Assembly wants that person to start a 10-year prison sentence. And I thank the detective for their input and say, well, I am the one that makes the charging decision, and I am not going to do that absent there being exceptional circumstances. So that is my personal opinion, and the office rarely will charge it absent there being a good reason that we go tell a defense attorney. And I'll close with this, and Robert can talk about this, and he can maybe talk about parole also. I trust our circuit court judges to do what's right. If it's a 5-year sentence that's deserved, I trust that I'll make the argument and the judge will impose that sentence if that's what's deserved. But I trust the judge to make that decision, and a defense attorney can present their arguments. The one thing I'll say about parole before turning it over to Robert is I think one of the driving forces of getting rid of parole is juries were thinking they were giving a certain sentence, and then people were only doing about 30% of it. So it was sort of more of a truth in sentencing thing where it's like, we're not going to have parole because, you know, you're not really understanding what sentence you're imposing. They're doing very little of it and getting paroled. But I think they are, Robert can probably talk about this, I think this session of the General Assembly is taking a look at that now because of some issues related to some of the overcrowding of the prisons. But that, to me, parole is a General Assembly question, not a prosecutor question.
With respect to parole, I saw that the incoming governor opposes any effort to revisit parole in Virginia, and that indicates that the principle of clear and determinate sentencing is a bipartisan one now. And what concerns me about having parole hearings ad infinitum is it re-victimizes some of the victims of crime where, you know, a relative is hurt, injured, or killed as a result of the misconduct of a defendant, and that victim has to reappear before the parole commission every so often to say, please keep him in, we're still suffering. And it's very clear that that imposes enormous psychic hardship on the people who we're most concerned about, and that's the victims and their families. So with respect to parole, I support a system that provides for clear, indeterminate sentencing on the sentencing date. With respect to mandatory sentences, I agree with Joe that discretion is very important. And when I was up in D.C., there's a group called Families Against Mandatory Minimums, who probably everyone knows here. They're very, very effective and persuasive. in demonstrating that sometimes mandatory minimums could be abused in charging decisions, particularly when you have a firearm with a drug crime in federal court. It's a very, very heavy hammer. But if you look at the history of that statute, you have to look back to the 80s when the crack epidemic was decimating the inner cities, and legislators on both sides of the aisle said, we really need to be very aggressive about making sure that the people who are engaging in this conduct, the nexus between violent crime and drug activity decimating the inner cities, required a clear legislative response. There was some guidance at the end of the Obama administration to disempower local prosecutors and assistant United States attorneys when it came to mandatory minimum charging decisions. I think it goes to each case, the discretion of each prosecutor. They shouldn't be overcharged. But there are always opportunities to charge and then reduce charges as you go forward. So charge five charges that have a mandatory minimum and drop several of them in exchange for a guilty plea. So that's where charge bargaining and the leverage that prosecutors have to obtain guilty pleas comes into play. We try to charge mandatory minimums when it's absolutely necessary, and they are an important tool. And if you go back again to the original evolution of mandatory sentencing in the federal system, it's Edward Kennedy and Joe Biden and others. I was up at a hearing when I was at Maine Justice when they were examining the disparity between crack and powder cocaine. And Joe Biden was on the committee, and he said, look, I was responsible for creating and supporting legislation to create this disparity, because that was the understanding at the time, that crack was affecting the inner city far more than powder was. And I thought it spoke to his honesty as a legislator to say, we've created this problem as legislators, and prosecutors are merely adhering to the law. And it was an opportunity to fix it, and they subsequently did.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a question for Mr. Platania. Excuse me. You have inherited much of the aftermath of August 12th here in Charlottesville, and I, in particular, was concerned about a video I was sent a while back about the incident that happened at the entrance to the parking garage. The video involving DeAndre Harris, several of the ralliers, but also, someone had pointed this out to me, one of DeAndre Harris's compatriots who was there with him appeared to precipitate much of the violence there that led to DeAndre Harris being attacked more, and the melee and went from there. I never heard one word about whether that particular African-American individual was identified and any involvement, any liability on his part was assessed. So I was interested in your comments on that.
Thank you for the question. So as Robert mentioned in his opening remarks, we're prohibited from talking about any pending criminal prosecution or criminal case. And so I won't do that. What we are able to do is comment on anything that's part of a public record. And I believe what you're referring to is an allegation against an individual named Corey Long, who is charged with an assault and battery where I think he grabbed an individual's flag that may have preceded what is alleged to have happened in the parking garage. And I only say that because I believe that is a publicly filed charge against Mr. Long that is pending in general district court. We just set it for trial today. So that's really all I'm able to say about that. Can't comment on it further.
I have a somewhat related question. The events of last summer certainly kept your predecessor busy. Mr. Tracy, I saw your name in the papers also. I thought the events occurred in the city of Charlottesville. Why were you involved?
The events of the 11th, the rally with the torches, that occurred in the county of Albemarle because that's university grounds. And so our office has authority to investigate that case, and we do have a couple of cases pending with respect to events that occurred that evening, and that's why. And it is a very interesting map. We literally had a case that I worked with Joe's predecessor on where an event occurred in a building, a university building, bisected by the county line. So we, and then we have a limited jurisdiction each way. And I just said, go ahead, Dave. You've got it. Let's not take the measuring tape out.
Hi, I'm Kate Fraley. I know you. I'm hopeful that Corey Long and DeAndre Harris's charges will be dropped, and I know you can't speak to that. I wonder, though, if you could teach us the process that happens now. So why do cases get delayed and put forward, and then what is anticipated will happen at the next meeting of those two cases? Can you say that? Like, what procedures, like?
Sure.
Okay.
So you're asking specifically about the prosecutions of Corey Long and DeAndre Harris.
Right.
So they each had a hearing this morning in general district court. They were each there for a control date. DeAndre Harris is currently charged with misdemeanor assault and battery. And everything I'm saying, by the way, is public record. Corey Long is currently charged with disorderly conduct and assault and battery. Today was just a status hearing where each of their defense attorneys came in, and we set them for trial. I believe Mr. Harris is set for trial in March, I think March 16th, and Mr. Long's trial is set for sometime in April. And really speaking more generally in every case, so once a case is charged in the state system, we're sort of done with that part, but then the charged individual gets an attorney, and then they have to look at what the evidence is against their client so that they can prepare and represent them and advise them, and so that takes some time. Then you've got to schedule it with witnesses for the Commonwealth, witnesses for the defense attorney schedule, and so all of those moving parts is a bit like herding cats, and the first time we were able to get the cases set with the attorney's schedules were March and April. I will also point out that when you're charged with a felony in Virginia, you have a right to a speedy trial. And if you're in jail, you must be tried within 5 months of your preliminary hearing. And if you are out on bond and your liberty is not restrained, you must be tried within 9 months of your preliminary hearing. Those speedy trial deadlines don't apply to misdemeanors in general district court. So that's the best we could do is March and April with everyone's calendars and schedules.
As we may have observed, the issue of mental health even can elevate to the highest office in the land. And I hope I'm not upsetting anyone. Nevertheless, you have drug courts. Why? Anyone who's watched maybe one episode of Locked Up on MSNBC knows that mental health issues are huge. You alluded to that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why we don't have some version of a mental health court, and I know you do, there are evaluations done, but why have we not, we may have made it to the mid-20th century on addressing mental health issues, but we really need to take a giant step.
I think Robert's got some good news for
you. We do.
I
mean, this is one of the things that, in the list, I didn't want to put too much in the overview, but one of the things I talked about was some sort of diversion for people who have mental health issues. And locking them up is an easy solution to a complex problem, which is very expensive, and they are released and they reoffend. And it's also produces enormous strain on the police department to have multiple calls for service, same person who is stealing packs of gum at 7-Eleven. So one of the things I did very early on, even before Dave Chapman got involved in the discussion, is to meet with local people about establishing a mental health / therapeutic docket. Met with Herb Stewart, who is a psychologist, and I was uncomfortable assessing someone's fitness to stand trial or someone's level of mental health pathology. So he was an important part of this conversation. Got together with OAR area stakeholders, and we have a mental health docket that is literally at the Supreme Court right now and should be approved any day. And we've got a hearing date, a docket. Judge Downer in the city is going to be doing the initial docket. We'll be a therapeutic team, of which I'll be a part, and Joe will be a part. And we will have precisely that in the area that we deserve. I think it's long overdue as well. A lot of people, the kind of tough-on-crime people, think, oh, you're being weak on criminals. I don't view it that way. I view it as getting people the help they need and reducing costs and reducing the prison population. We have tremendous need for that. The one thing I ensured in that entire criteria section was Kamal's attorney has broad authority to veto people from entry. There's a concern to public health or safety. If that person has ever laid a hand on a child, they're just not going to be eligible, and I certainly would veto them.
I'd like to add one real quick comment. Sometimes the criminal justice system is a bludgeon when you need a scalpel, and we sometimes, you know, don't do well with nuance. But about in the mental health treatment court that's coming to this community is long overdue, and credit Robert and many others who are going to bring it here. That's great news. But 10 or 15 years ago, I'm a little bit biased, but I think Charlottesville-Albemarle really has no reason to not be one of the most progressive criminal justice systems in the entire state of Virginia. Like, there's no reason we shouldn't be leading the way with criminal justice reforms and advancements. And that's in areas like DNA that Robert talked about, but it's also in ways like addressing mental health issues. But 10 or 15 years ago, CIT training was brought to this community, which is crisis intervention team training. And what they did is they said, it started in Memphis, Tennessee, where an officer shot an armed mentally ill individual because the officer wasn't trained in de-escalation and noticing an individual that was having an episode of mental illness. And so we brought that training to the police departments of Albemarle County, Charlottesville, and UVA, and they have little badges. If you see police officers, they've got CIT pins. And they're specially trained and specially called out when there might be a mental health episode happening, and they're trained in de-escalation and talking to people and identifying what might be going on. And people say, well, why aren't all officers trained in de-escalation? And they should be. But these are officers that have gone through, I think, 40 hours of training to be able to specially identify and interact with folks and intervene and divert them away from the criminal justice system and arrest and divert them into medical care and treatment. So there have been some things going on before the mental health treatment docket. And we're, you know, we routinely work with the jail if there's an individual there that they feel might not be competent, and trying to work with defense attorneys to work out alternatives to prosecutions for folks that are, have mental health issues that might not otherwise qualify for the mental health docket. We've got a long way to go, though, but we're, you know, taking a few baby steps, which is promising.
Wait one second, Rich. I'm going to put in a plug at this point for an upcoming program we have. When you talk drug courts or mental health dockets, you're talking about forms of what is called generically criminal justice reform. In March, we are having a session on criminal justice reform. The speaker is a fellow named Pat Nolan. Pat Nolan was some years ago the Republican leader of the California State Assembly, the lower house of the California legislature. Shortly after the Abscam scandal that enveloped a bunch of members of Congress, the FBI, some eager beavers, decided they would try to pull a sting on members of the California legislature. Pat got caught up in it. He was overcharged. His lawyer told him essentially, if you don't plead guilty to one felony count, you could end up spending the rest of your productive life in jail. So he pled guilty, and he spent about 2 years in a federal prison. He is now the executive director of the American Conservative Union Foundation Center for Criminal Justice Reform, and he'll be coming here to talk in March. Rich?
Robert, you talked about the mental health courts, and I'm wondering whether that also applies to veterans. We see a large number of military folks partially because of the wars, but partially because of the multiple deployments, coming back with PTSD and traumatic brain injuries and committing suicides and crimes. And I wondered if the mental health courts will deal with the veterans, or whether there's a separate possibility of a separate court system for
absolutely.
Veterans with PTSD.
It will absolutely deal with veterans who have mental health issues. We won't probably create a separate veterans docket of the kind that exists in some jurisdictions where there's a very heavy military presence of veterans. But, and I can speak to this generically, we had a case. I personally handled a case within the last several months of a veteran who was calling, and it was a difficult case. He was calling for help, and no one would come, and he discharged a firearm, his AR-15. And it was an unoccupied dwelling next door, and it was a very serious offense. But it was a cry for help. And I worked with Liz Murtaugh on it, and he seemed to be the perfect candidate for the mental health docket. And he would have been probably our first candidate, but he doesn't live here. And one of the requirements are residency. Fortunately, after this event a few months ago, he was put in touch with a mental health counselor at the VA. He has sessions that are regular, and he is under supervision in another jurisdiction, but precisely the type of person who brings together all of the factors that you just mentioned, and in a community that we have an obligation to care about, given the horrendous suicide, prevalence of suicide in that community, which is, again, staggering.
Yes, sir.
Regarding reform on a grand scale, our country is usually cited as having the largest or the second largest prison population in the world, per capita and also in absolute number, as I understand it. And that's a historic artifact, I think, of racism, but I'd be curious to hear your attitude to that. And it persists. We keep maintaining large prisons with large numbers of people in them all across the country, both state and federal. It's probably overkill. What do you think about it, and what's the prospect for doing something about it?
So there's that saying when, you know, you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And, you know, I think as prosecutors, that's a good thought to keep in mind, that not everything is a nail. I would highly recommend a book called Locked In, L-O-C-K-E-D-I-N, by John Pfaff, P-F-A-F-F. And the premise of the book is that there's not one criminal justice system that over-incarcerates people in this country, but that there's 3,227 criminal justice systems led by people like Robert Tracy and Joe Platania. Each of these 3,227 criminal justice systems are individual and are led by elected, in most cases, prosecutors. And so the problem with the criminal justice system, according to Mr. Pfaff, is prosecutors. He said that's the problem, is the prosecutors that make charging decisions and that recommend sentences and that in many ways affect the flow of a criminal prosecution. He said if you really want true reform, you need to elect prosecutors that are going to do something about their own locality and their own criminal justice system. So I answer questions from citizens in the city like that, that I really can only affect what happens in the city of Charlottesville and our criminal justice system. And it is a priority for us to divert low-risk individuals away from incarceration. There's evidence that says we're harming folks that are low risk when they're incarcerated. We're doing damage to them when we put them in jail and they're low risk. Now, if there's a low risk individual that for reasons of public safety or that there's a victim that wants there to be a consequence involving incarceration, there's exceptions to that. But right now we're working on a program to try and have low risk people not go to jail is part of their consequence for their criminal action, but go to a work site and perform 8 hours of community service, which would be the equivalent of one day in jail. So again, there's some exciting stuff going on in this community, and I think that we're learning that jail sometimes not only isn't the answer in every case, but sometimes it's causing harm. So that's an answer from, again, just the city's perspective about that issue, but I think it is a valid one.
And I agree with the sentiment underlying Joe's point about that. We have no interest in incarcerating low-level nonviolent offenders. And the people we do see and the people we do incarcerate are people who have offended in the past. The sentencing guidelines are very clear as to when jail time is something that the guidelines would consider appropriate. The judge has some sentencing discretion within those guidelines, but that's a legislative choice and also the Sentencing Commission, and we are not legislators. We apply the law as it is, not how we might want it, and that's the humility of being a prosecutor, and it's a very important principle to me. In our community, in Albemarle last year, there was one first year I got there was one homicide. Last year there were five. So we have seen a spike in violent crime in our community. And it is very important to, as Joe's story earlier indicated, there is sometimes a nucleus of violent activity often associated with gang violence in our community. And there is a nexus between violent gangs, drugs, and other types of violent crimes and felonies. And those are important issues that we can't ignore. We can't be selective about aggressively prosecuting crimes of that nature.
I'm just curious as to how the case against this young man who threatened the Monticello High School is going, and whether he's going to get 1 to 10 years. You probably can't say that at this point.
Well, he was charged. It was a charging decision under Virginia Code 18.2-60A2, in case anyone's a legal nerd here. And it's a threat against the school, and he was, and that was the charge that was taken out as a result of that threat. And that's all I can speak about, just the public nature of that charge. And he's a juvenile, so his name, you know, won't be in the public record. But it's something we take very seriously, obviously, and have to be very cautious and react very quickly and proactively toward. And to the question about, I just wanted to, one more point about violence and over-incarceration. There is a gang task force here, anti-gang task force called GRACE. It stands for a Gang Reduction Through Active Community Engagement. And we cannot incarcerate, as Joe mentioned, everyone in the community. So I believe in proactive outreach. I was selected to serve on the executive board of that group, and I think it does enormously important work to try to identify at-risk youth and divert them away from gang violence. It's difficult, but it's worthwhile. So my solution to the criminal problem in our community is not to incarcerate everyone. It's to be very smart and selective about targeting the major players. And I've heard people refer to spearfishing versus, you know, rounding up everyone who's even vaguely associated with crime. You have to go after the people who are instigating, promoting, and leading these criminal organizations and array all of the law enforcement authority that we have to get at the people who are bringing violence to our community.
Yes, ma'am. I'm
going to put a positive spin on my question. Given the obvious degree of cooperation between you as individuals and your two offices, what are the hurdles that have to be gotten over to keep the county courts downtown?
The county courts? Yeah, your voices are important because we have been very clear and unified in the belief that the interests of justice are served with a co-located court system. And we were speaking about this earlier. One of the things that troubles me, frankly, is the board determining what is in the interests of justice and assuming authority to determine that they alone can weigh in on what affects the administration of justice. And I don't want to sound like a legal nerd, but there was a Supreme Court case a few years ago called Kelo versus City of New London. And it actually spawned an amendment to the Virginia Constitution a couple of years ago. And it was a Supreme Court case where a majority of the Supreme Court determined that they had authority to determine when adverse possession and the condemnation authority under the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause, where you can condemn public private land for a public use. And the Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court, said, yes, we are lawyers, unaccountable, Supreme Court of the United States. We alone are going to uphold the right of zoning officials to determine whether that burden is met and whether economic development is a sufficient basis to condemn private land. And the reaction on Capitol Hill at the time was bipartisan. And the NAACP in particular was very furious, because a lot of these local zoning boards will come into a disaffected, blighted area and say, we're going to level the place and create Trump Tower, just, you know, for the sake of an argument. And people rebelled, and they should have, because that's not the role of justices on the Supreme Court. And Justice Kennedy was very disappointed about his opinion, and Justice Stevens as well spoke to how he regretted that decision. So in this case, I think the Board of Supervisors just statutorily and constitutionally not entrusted with authority as to what is in the interest of justice. And the community has spoken. Commonwealth attorneys, the clerks of court, the sheriffs, everyone affected by the move has spoken fairly clearly and emphatically that it would undermine access to justice, particularly among indigent people. Public Defender's Office represents Charlottesville and Albemarle. They're in court walking across the street all day long. Legal Aid Justice Center. It would be a mistake for all those reasons to move the court outside of where it is right now.
Amen.
Are there further questions?
I was upset to hear you say that you could remove the number of previous offenses when a person goes in front of a judge. I think that's deceitful. If the judge doesn't know that you had three priors or four priors, and the judge just thinks you're there for the first time, it could change the decision of the judge.
So I didn't explain myself accurately then. So when a case file is brought to me, and any prosecutor, we have to advise and make charging decisions. So we have the individual's criminal history. And so if I have someone that's alleged to have sold drugs, I can choose to indict them for a first offense with no mandatory minimum, a second offense with a 3-year mandatory minimum, or a third offense with a 10-year mandatory minimum. If I indict for the first offense and we go to trial and they're convicted, a jury will see their whole prior record. And if they're convicted or plead guilty, a judge will see their whole prior record. So all the information is given to the jury or the judge that's recommending or imposing a sentence. But what you're doing is you're not handcuffing a jury or a judge where they have to start at 10 years. But all of that information is absolutely put before a jury or a judge, and they can give them 10 years. I just don't think it's wise for a prosecutor to say, I'm going to make you start there. And so that information is always put before the judge or the jury.
But if they've had three or four previous offenses, why don't you want them to start there?
Because I think each case is individual and you've got to look at it, but I don't think that someone that sells $20 worth of crack, which is a Tic Tac, needs to go to prison for 10 years if they have two priors.
I do.
And it's sort of under John Ashcroft, when he was Attorney General, he had this Ashcroft memorandum, and it said, prosecutors shall charge the most serious, readily provable offense. And that was the standard for most of the Obama administration. And then Eric Holder issued his memorandum according greater discretion to line prosecutors to charge things in accordance with they thought was in the best interest of justice. But it goes to a fundamental tension we have as prosecutors. If someone is committing a violent felony with a firearm, there's a mandatory minimum, And our office doesn't ignore the presence of the firearm. I'm not suggesting Joe's does either. But the legislature has spoken, and we have an obligation to adhere to the law. They've been very clear that nexus between violent crime and firearms is something the community has spoken clearly and emphatically on, and that's a message we certainly hear and adhere to every time we have cases like that.
Madison?
Immigration. And we know that our immigration system is not broken, but it has some problems, whether we're talking about, we don't need to be talking about DACA or the DREAM Act or a ridiculous wall, but we need to, I look at both of your names, and I'm saying this as a boring Scots-Irish descendant who came, whose folks came here 250 or 300 years ago, but I look at both of your last names, and all of us, as you know, are immigrants. What are your policies in regard to either the county or the city becoming sanctuary entities, as far as how do you address that as prosecutors?
Well, there's
ICE were to come in.
There's really no such thing as a sanctuary city. That's sort of a misunderstanding I think the public has, is that a sanctuary city is some official city that, you know, resists or ignores laws. There really isn't such a thing. There's things that are in the state of flux with the law now. I think under the previous administration, they had some, you know, safe harbors carved out, hospitals, churches, and I think some of this is gray right now. I answer that question as follows. When you prosecute someone, there's always something that is, or there's oftentimes something that's called a collateral consequence. So if you prosecute someone for a felony, there's a collateral consequence that they can't possess a firearm, they can't vote, and they can't serve on a jury until their rights are restored. There may be a collateral consequence that if someone that's enrolled at the University of Virginia is convicted of an offense involving lying, stealing, or cheating, they might be expelled. That's a collateral consequence. If you prosecute someone that is undocumented in this community and they receive an active jail sentence, there's a chance that the collateral consequence will arise where federal authorities are notified and they're deported. So to me, any good prosecutor will consider in any prosecution what the collateral consequence is to what you're doing. And I have strong personal views on incarcerating someone for a very low-level misdemeanor offense, like driving on a suspended license, when the remedy for most people is go pay your costs and get your license back. But if you're undocumented, we won't let you do that. You can't avail yourself to the normal remedy, which is to get your license. So I think if you're going to impose an active jail sentence for someone that's driving on a suspended license that's not documented, and you won't let them get a license, and you know that they're likely to be deported, you better be thinking about that when you make that decision to craft a resolution to the case and recommend or bargain for an active jail sentence. It's case by case. I don't want to dodge your question, but I think that is, in many cases, an overly drastic and draconian collateral consequence that you need to think about, and there are ways to avoid it. You can have them do community service. And some people say, well, that you're treating them better than someone else who is here legally and they have to go to jail. So there's problems with it, but I think it's something that thoughtful prosecutors need to make sure they're thinking about in a variety of contexts, and it's just what is the collateral consequence that's going to come about based on this criminal prosecution, and that's the city.
You mentioned my last name. If my middle name was up there, it's Nada, and if my mom and dad were switched, my mom's maiden name is Gonzalez. She's from Spain, and my mom was born in Spain. My dad was born in Brazil to Italian grandparents. So my proximity to, you know, the issue is much closer. But my parents are both legal immigrants, and there is a distinction between illegal immigration and legal immigration, lost deliberately in the public discussion of the issue. With respect to, and I'm glad that we finally found something to disagree on.
We're both still Italian, though.
We are, yeah, but... The issue for me, and this presents itself quite often, is do you accord different treatment to someone based on their citizenship status? And I think the answer has to be no. So if someone is driving under the influence, second offense, within 5 years, there's some jail time that ought to go with it. And I'm certainly not going to look to their immigration status and say, okay, you're in the country illegally, so we're going to treat you differently than Bob Smith from Scottsville. There's no way I'm going to do that. And I'm not invested with authority to determine what the federal immigration law is. The Supreme Court's been very clear that it's a uniquely federal responsibility, a plenary federal power to determine a uniform rule of naturalization under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. I'm not going to substitute my judgment for the Supreme Court's or the Constitution. So I look at the defendant, and we had a case of a Canadian person who was in the immigration system, and if convicted of the offense, might have jeopardized his status. And I said, I'm not going to look at immigration status at all. I'm not going to treat anyone differently on the basis of alienage. I'm going to treat them the same way. And that's what I've been doing.
This will be the last question.
Through the Justice Department, DHS has developed a program where they're using sheriffs as the tip of the spear to make ICE arrests.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's been at least one situation in Albemarle where a local resident was arrested by ICE or by a sheriff through ICE and taken immediately to Farmville. My question to you is, do you have any jurisdiction or any authority to help someone who's living in Albemarle County in that situation?
It's a program under, I think it's 287G of the Immigration Naturalization Act, and you can deputize local jurisdictions to help enforce the immigration laws. My knowledge, the Albemarle County does not participate in that program. I will say that since the election of President Trump, some illegal immigrants have been detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement after their incarceration. So the number of offenses where unlawful residents are subject to a jail term, those cases are now being tried because they might be detained after their incarceration for the offense. And I'm not unsympathetic to that plight, but I have a difficult time reconciling my obligations to be fair and consistent and to accord different status to someone based on their legal status in the country.
One was the situation where a person was called as a witness to court who was an illegal immigrant, and they were arrested as they left.
I have not. When was this?
This was in Culpeper.
I'm sorry.
It was not here. It was in Culpeper. There was a person arrested in Crozet and taken to Farmville who was a longtime resident, but we can talk about that. My question was whether you have any authority to intervene on behalf of the citizen of the community in that case.
We have no legislative authority that I can. I don't think so. I mean, the board could direct the police department to participate in that program. And people do make solid arguments that sometimes if every illegal immigrant thinks that when they call the police, police are going to show up and arrest everyone, it might impact their willingness to cooperate with law enforcement. I certainly have no interest in doing that. It's a charging decision. It's serious offenses, violent offenses. We had in our office fairly recently, an illegal immigrant threatened to kill one of our assistants in the office. And we can't say, oh, he might be deported. No. That is a collateral consequence, but it's a collateral consequence of being in the country illegally.
Well, and Robert's not suggesting this. I want to be clear. There's not a litmus test that if you're undocumented, you don't go to jail. There are certain instances, like DUI. I'm sorry, there's a mandatory jail sentence, and you're undocumented. That's your own problem. I'm being very specific about certain types of lower-level offenses, and I know Robert wasn't suggesting that. I just want to make that clear.
Please join me in thanking our panel.